So this is about verifying identity, and it's one of many security-related mobile finance apps. We will give individuals much more control of their security and not just be protecting them from bad things, but helping them protect themselves and be empowered as consumers and businesses in ways we haven't seen before. Certainly mobile banking, which is absolutely here to stay. The data makes it very clear. If you're wondering if mobile banking is the real deal, because just like with the first time that we had online banking that was experimented with back in the 1980s and failed, we retrenched and then came out with it in the mid-90s, and then it succeeded. Mobile banking, we're on version 2.0. All those companies, literally 100% of the original set of vendors, came and went. Now that we're back, if you look at iPhone users, half, one out of every two of U.S. iPhone users are now doing mobile banking on a regular basis. I don't know about you, but that number shocks me. And yet, that iPhone population group, if you want to follow an indicator of future usage patterns, you really can't look to classic indicators like age or income. Mobile finance usage defies those categories, but iPhone users who span a lot of diverse categories will tell you what everybody else is going to be using next. So we define that as monitoring and managing finances at the simplest level. There's mobile commerce and shopping, which is buying via the mobile device, generally for the mobile device. Very different than this last item, which we call mobile wallet. You can call it a lot of different things. But if I'm downloading a ringtone or screensaver or something like that that makes my mobile device itself work better, well, I mean, that's so common, and it's been around so long. This is a part of the mainstream today. There's mobile marketing, which gets really interesting and is another app that, along with authentication, that uses geolocation. So, we're really hindered by a rudimentary U.S. telco system compared to other modern economies around the world. But as we get more geolocation capabilities and fatter pipes underneath the system, underneath the devices, then we'll enable more attraction, cross-selling, keeping customers via mobile devices, and something we called for a long time just happened a couple weeks ago, Wells Fargo actually treating the mobile channel finally as an entirely distinct channel where you can sign up and get a mobile banking account separate from an online account. They're the only bank that offers that in the U.S., and prior to that, nobody offered it. There's mobile payments, which, again, find this any way you like. We're defining it as one person sending funds to another person. It's been around a long time. It's been available a long time. Talking to Dixon, it was PayPal's original model when they were started, but they said, really another model has worked out a lot better for them, which is auction-based payments via desktops and laptops. But, of course, they've been offering that a long time. But now we're starting to see growth, and this is an example where your old demographic models of saying, let's look to affluent young people, especially males, they'll be the early adopters. Mobile just defies all those traditional rules because you see underserved and underbanked consumers showing some of the highest levels of interest. And this is where financial services can really get back to being about services, and you can replace some other businesses that offer some more questionable value propositions, like check cashing services and so forth. There's the mobile wallet area, which is where we really can leave the wallet or the purse at home and not really be sorry we did, not even maybe notice that we did for a couple of days. Let's face it, the photos, the notes, all that stuff are on the mobile device for a lot of people. I don't know about you, but for me, they're already there. And as we get to that and we load in all these other things that lay the rails, then we'll get to the mobile wallet. So I'm not going to get into details on this slide. There's just a lot here. It's really a leave behind for you. But I just want to let you know, we divide this up, and as Marianne and I talked about dividing up the content, wanting to break out the different models of from the left to the right and the top. SMS text, which is really like a separate way of interacting with your financial or payments provider, then using WAP and browser-based banking, and some phones allow that more than others, some networks, some plans. Security is an entirely different animal than downloadable applications, which the world has been changed by that, by iPhones and Droids and Prees and, of course, Blackberries. And then embedded applications, which allow the telcos, which everyone is wondering, are they going to be the next financial community that needs to have a different set of regulations and oversight attached to them? So these all work very differently, and there's different consumer and business models, and we've identified some of that. So if you look at the ecosystem, the broadest level, there's a mobile subscriber. We generally think of consumers when we think of this, but we could just as well be thinking of business users. And we talk about wanting to protect this person, and we say sometimes the best way to protect this person is to do what we call deputizing this person, because a lot of the best banking systems, the most effective banking systems at stopping this identity fraud crime, sometimes called identity theft, it just doesn't go away this year. The report we just came out with a couple of months ago, we acknowledge the FTC's original good work in the design of that, and this year, Wells and Intersections and Fiserv and Better Business Bureau being a part of that release. When we did this project, we found the latest ID fraud numbers in the U.S. just on the amount of the crime was $54 billion. Good news is the consumer is only paying $373 out of pocket. I mean, it's bigger than zero, so it's bad news, but it's a lot lower than people think, because the business community is paying out of that average $4,851 per spree of interrelated crimes, businesses are paying all but $373. So this is a big cost that no one's talking about. That doesn't count the cost of all the mitigation systems that prevent, detect, and resolve the crime. But we believe very firmly that it's not a whim. It's what we see in the data when we look at the patterns of the crimes, that the best way to protect this consumer or end user, the financial account holder, the identity holder, is to actually empower them and see the technology as a two-edged sword. Because some of the best, completing thought I was on to a moment ago, some of the best back-end technologies and methods, fraud filters, neural nets, all this stuff, fundamentally what they're doing is trying to think like the customer. They're trying to be like this big brain that, you know, that would say, if you had the customer right there, you, instead of using the technology, you'd say, oh, is that you? Are you out of the country right now? Yeah, do you want to approve that transaction? Well, we're programming the systems to think like the customer. If the customer is right there, we'd say, is that you? They go, no, it's not me, before the computer could respond, and much more accurately. So as mobile devices are connected to individuals and they're actually standing in the line buying the item, why wouldn't we just send somebody a message with the strongest authentication and give people alert messages, which work, you're going to think I'm a little bit out there when I say this, but rather than working like they work with financial alert messages, which if I have one criticism about current banking systems, it's the alerts are really very bad today. They're incredibly ineffective, and we have a press release out of that today, but they don't require much changes to make them really phenomenal. And the way they need to work is actually a lot like how people manage their music electronically. You get a message, you get a song, you say, I want more like the one I just heard. Less like that next one. And you're constantly aware of how much money you have as a consumer or business account holder. You have this ever-present awareness, and if you're in Brazil and you don't want your card shut off, your financial provider does it, and if you're not in Brazil and you don't want a slew of transactions that have to $4,800 all of a sudden be committed, those don't happen. So that's how we power the customer. That's what we've seen in our data. So mobile operators, different versions of phone plans. I'm sorry, some of you can't see us over here, but I think you have notes. Looks like right. SMS, WAP, downloadables, all that. You know, and the one thing that I think some of the reasons that we all, as people that have worked hard, you know, our education, our professional experience, and all that, so often get some of this technology wrong is, you know, if you think about simple numbers, you know, you see some major change happen that you've been working on. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I generally get about, from the gut feeling, I get about half of it right. You know, there's a lot of things that we as an industry have sometimes been right on, sometimes not. Consumers or business owners, they don't want to have their convenience disrupted to be more secure. That's true. And yet, we all often hear things like, I'm just making the point about not getting caught up in preconceived notions that actually cause us to make bad decisions, whether that's commercial decisions or regulatory decisions, what have you. Has anybody ever heard the urban legend that zero liability policies cause consumer motivation to go down in terms of protecting themselves? Would you be surprised to know that actually the opposite is solidly true? those individuals that most value zero liability policies, which come from $50 liability limit regulated policy, those individuals that most value that actually are most vigilant in taking other measures to protect themselves. So it would be true to say that zero liability policies actually cause more individuals to be more active in their own self-protection. It would take a psychologist and behaviorist to explain why that's the case. That's not what I do, but the point is a lot of those preconceived notions can get in our way. So when we look at how all these providers play out, if we were to take 50% of the our accuracy rate on the next technology and multiply that four times over as the industry rolls out, we'd be 6% correct after four major waves of technology. And our point is that mobile will change things a lot, and we have to make sure we're grounded, in fact, to have good policy decisions. When we look at this end game, if you will, because I'd love to hear anybody's comments later on if you have a thought, but you know, when I think about mobile finance rolling out, it's hard for me to imagine a bigger end game than people leaving the wallet of the purse at home. And it's and everything else, every other mobile finance app we identify, it really rolls up to this. And we think this can be great for business, great for consumers, great for strength of just us as a country. But there's so many things that have to change in order to have that happen, and so many experimental new technologies. And one of the key things, because this involves a lot of alternative payments, as they're often called, you have to decide what's an alternative payment. So, for example, is PayPal an alternative payment? Well, in its realm, it represents about 90% of the payments that are done in the area in which it's strongest, which is auction-based payments and all those other auction users that send funds from one to another. So you can argue about what's alternative and what's mainstream, but I would say this, if we want to identify through a model which alternative payments providers are likely to succeed next year, year after that, what we found to be a tried and true model for having a highest accuracy rate is to look for a balanced value proposition. Look for an alternative payments company that offers the most balanced, not necessarily the strongest, value to any one entities meaning consumer or small medium business user, the merchant community, and the financial issuers that roll this stuff out. Those three primary communities. If you look at all those three and you say, what's the value proposition of one alternative payments provider, and this model will see just a flood of them coming out, which is why I'm talking about it. That's the best way we found to be predictive, you know, in terms of who will succeed and what business models will succeed. And certainly, security is going to be just crucial as we go through all this as well. You know, there's a lot of surprises about security, particularly in regard to data breaches right now. We had been among the voices saying for a long time that we couldn't find a correlation between data breaches and actual consumer likelihood of becoming a fraud victim. And so you heard that come out a lot. Others started saying that as well. And then we had to actually do a 180 degree change on our position, because actually as we looked at data, I brought a new statistician on and looked at actually some old data. I'm kind of embarrassed to say it was looking back over a couple of years of data, just dusted some of it off, and we said, you know, we missed something in looking at some longitudinal data history, and found that actually there was a four times increased likelihood of you becoming an actual fraud victim, real fraud, not just a victim of a breach, but actual fraudulent transactions, if you get one of those data breach notification letters. And I point that out because that's our trigger for knowing that the individual had a higher likelihood of becoming a fraud victim. And of course, there's regulatory policies that determine whether you get a letter or not. So the point is, you know, as we looked at the data more extensively, we found this, and we have a real problem on our hands with data breaches, which relate back to a lot of the endpoints like merchant communities and the acquiring community, where some of the largest data breaches have occurred, and other areas like that. So they're actually not occurring as frequently at the issuers, at the banks themselves, but that's where a lot of the brunt is being felt, and then, you know, you could argue about where the losses are being incurred. So this is a complex slide. I'll zero in on just a couple of simple areas, but which is this point as well, and start to hit on it so repeatedly. I just find from a regulatory standpoint, particularly this point about empowering the end user, it's not just a nice-to-have message. It's really a need-to-have for just the protection and the good of everyone. But so here's where it gets interesting, because it's, you know, it's nice to say those broad brush things, but what do you do about it? Well, if we look at the security impact of various apps, and I'm using slightly different language, thanks for your patience here, for the purpose of pointing out where the security opportunities or threats, kind of a mini SWOT analysis, if you will, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. From apps on the left side, so mobile marketing, alerts, authentication, fourth down, review and release alerts, where the account holder or maybe the identity holder, where you're trying to protect against new account fraud. And alerts aren't just about security, that's for sure. They're also about helping people work toward financial goals or just have more convenient access to their funds. So once we get alerts to send a message out to someone that they as an individual can respond to, which can go horribly wrong if the security isn't in place, because maybe we're allowing the criminal who has their hands on the phone to do the responding and say, yeah, that transaction is okay, by the way. Lift all my previously instilled limits on those foreign transfers. Just open them all up. Thank you. You know? So, yeah, these can be a horrible thing, or they can be a wonderful thing by taking all these smarts, these big brain neural nets, fraud filters, all that great back-end stuff, device fingerprinting, and then getting the individual to be plugged in on that. Now, but the review and release alerts, here's my point on this, is that if we accept the idea that empowering the identity holder and the account holder, consumer business, whatever, is a great way forward for effectiveness and new business models and safety, that I think will really finally drop this ID fraud number that has never gone down since, you know, the FTC first reported on in 03, and then we've even been reporting 6 years since. It just doesn't really dip below 50 billion. And that's easily a $100 billion crime out to the financial community when you look at the mitigation cost. So this review and release part, I think, is the key that gets us out to mobile payments. Because once you have people having access to their financial accounts and they can respond to real-time messages, somebody's thinking, well, the real-time systems aren't there. I know. But this is where real-time systems have a value proposition that they've never had before, the core banking system. Real-time system. I worked for a real-time banking system for credit unions, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that, you know, 12 years ago. And it's a big so what in the industry. But once you connect it out to the end user, it becomes relevant, along with so many other things. Aggregation technologies start to get relevant. So payment transfers, all this stuff. So the point is that the security has many plus pluses or minus minuses, or depending on which application we're looking at. And the adoption is very different, and everything from review and release alerts, which I've seen television commercials for some banks today, and I could swear they'd be available. And yet, I can tell you from my data, they actually don't exist. But they're in a few parts of the world, like South Africa and a few places in Eastern Europe, where fraud is just out of control. By and large, they mostly don't exist at any kind of a practical level. And there's others that are growing very fast, like mobile banking to 50% of the end users. You can also, I would tell you that there is opportunity to mine some of the data and make great policy decisions, whether you're a financial services vendor, policymaker, payment provider, whatever. And a great example, I don't know if it came from a meeting I had, and I'm hopefully not betraying any confidence or anything, but one of the last times I had the privilege of presenting before the Board of Governors was probably about 5 years ago. And I had said some similar comments about saying, let's not go too far with just trying to be, where I use paternalistic and protecting the consumer, but also think of empowering the consumer, because they want to get involved and the tools just aren't being shared with them. And somebody had said to me, kind of in a question and answer in front of a group similar to this size, well, what could we do? Or are there any opportunities for policy that don't exist yet, that you see from your data, that, you know, where one policy decision could really make a difference? And I had big, thick ID fraud report. And I said, yeah, you know, we see an unbelievable correlation between address changes and ID fraud. So if an address has been fraudulently changed, you are much more likely to have the worst form of ID fraud occur. You know, the most damaging in terms of hours, out-of-pocket losses to the financial community, to consumers and all that. And you know, address changes and red flag rules weren't talked about at that time. And I don't know if that conversation a long time ago actually had to do with this change being made. Now we see a very positive thing. I think we're great public-private cooperation happen. And when we look at that, we actually see banks that have mostly notified consumers, and we have the data from mystery shopping on that. So a couple things. I've got a forecast in here of mobile banking adoption. We're bullish on it, and in a couple of years are actuals. When we look at consumers, we don't want to overlook the fact the majority of consumers are not yet doing mobile banking and getting any kind of alerts, and so we have a tremendous amount of work to do. And a lot of them simply don't see the value. They have several stages of new technologies to adopt to get there. Underserved people, as I mentioned earlier, are a tremendous opportunity. And this is where financial services can really be this win-win of helping people get more control of their financial lives. Literally, I think everybody wins except for unscrupulous businesses and criminals as we do this, if we do it right. And by that, I mean, I think I see people paying more fees and feeling good about it, because they're moved closer to their financial goals. What mobile finance features are top financial institutions offering? We have about 15 here that we recommend as being the highest priority. We divide them up on the left as being among mobile monitoring, simple mobile monitoring, money movements, which has a different set of security and infrastructure implications, to advanced capabilities down here, from bilingual to viewing rates and two-way alerts and unique enrollment and banking. You know, as soon as we come out with these charts, you know, somebody will make it obsolete by offering a new product, so somebody has some of this now. But you'll see that there's a great difference, which says there's a lot of room ahead, a lot of runway, if you will, and you know, a lot of takeoff room too for providers to roll out new features. The mobile channel, from a security standpoint, I'm going to say something, it'll probably be a little controversial, and if anybody wants to question, you know, what the details are or where we get it from, happy to take any of that as we have time to be in for questions. But this represents the downside of a particular channel. You know, there's about 8 or 9 major channels, from branches to mobile to online and ATM, whatever. The red is the downside, roughly, compared to mobile, online, you know, internet, voice. And we could show them all up here, but for simplicity, we didn't. And the upside, how much can we improve somebody's security? And what we see here is that as we've analyzed a variety of features, there are actually, we believe, more security advantages available. We're not necessarily predicting how quickly they'll get rolled out, but the technology exists today, number one, and consumers have shown us motivation, number two. So we think we can improve security through mobile, but of course we have to do it right. As we look at the outlook, you know, there's so many ways. I mentioned before, if you get a picture half right 4 times in a row, you're 6% right after just that many iterations. So how do we get ourselves to mobile payments and make a lot of money for honest people and scrupulous businesses and strengthen the economy and protect consumers, all those good things? We think the technology to watch is review and release alerts. We're not pretending that there are not significant changes in core banking systems and business models and significant security concerns. All those loom large, but we believe that to go today from mobile banking showing high penetration among segments to eventually where you leave your wallet and your purse at home and you just don't even mind. You say, I guess I don't need that anymore. We think the review and release alerts are the technology to watch, and I'm glad to be a part of a group that includes policymakers, because that's key to be able to do that right.